This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. When Paul Giamatti first started acting, he was probably best known as the son of the late Yale professor and baseball commissioner Bart Giamatti. But this character actor with regular guy looks has turned in so many memorable performances in supporting roles that he's now become a leading man. He played Howard Stern's obnoxious boss in the film Private Parts and had roles in Saving Private Ryan, The Truman Show, and Man on the Moon. He landed a leading role as the underground cartoonist Harvey Pekar in American Splendor and won critical praise as the depressed wine snob Miles in the film Sideways. And last year, he starred with Laura Linney in the seven-part HBO series John Adams. Giamatti's new film is an absurdist comedy based on the idea that a high-tech company in New York has developed a way to extract and store the souls of people who feel burdened by them and want to relieve anxiety. Giamatti plays an actor named Paul Giamatti, who's rehearsing for the Chekhov play Uncle Vanya and is struggling with the role. He decides to consider soul extraction, and in this scene, he sits down with the scientist running the program, played by David Strathairn.
People come here, and, they all want to know if the soul is immortal and how it functions, and we haven't a clue.
No clue. We only offer the possibility to de-soul the body or disembody the soul. You can see it either way. You can also take a look on the inside before we start.
Look on the inside? I don't want to look on the inside.
It's entirely up to you.
Yeah.
Now, your soul will be stored here, or if you'd rather avoid sales tax, it can be shipped to our New Jersey warehouse.
No, I don't want my soul shipped to New Jersey. No,
I understand. What exactly is bothering you?
Well, Paul Giamatti, welcome back to Fresh Air. This film, Cold Souls, is, if I have this right, is in part the work of your own production company. So this is not just an acting role. I assume that you were involved in this project early on. Tell us when you first heard about this idea, extracting your soul, and what appealed to you.
I met the director, Sophie Bart, at the Nantucket Film Festival, and she had just won an award for this screenplay. The idea came from a dream she had in which Woody Allen discovered that his soul had been extracted and was in fact a legume and not anything very impressive. So what appealed to me right off the bat was the concept of it. This idea of soul removal was very amusing to me, and I was very taken with the whole kind of affectionate treatment of something of a sort of stereotype of the Russian soul in it, and the kind of the Russian-ness and the Eastern European sensibility that pervaded the whole thing. The fact that she'd written it for me was very flattering. But it was the story, and it was her that appealed to me.
Well, one of the things, without giving too much of the story away, in this film, you as this actor decide you're going to agree to have your soul extracted by this company that can do it so that you are unburdened. And then you as an actor in playing the part has to portray someone who is soulless. How did you approach that?
Well, I think part of the idea was, at least as the director conceived of it, was, the character is very self-involved in the first place. He's become very wrapped up in his own agony and angst, and he thinks, yes, that this is going to help him. And what does happen is that he becomes more self-involved. There seems to be some way in which, the soul functions as a superego, as a kind of regulating device or something. So he becomes wildly overconfident about the idiotic choices that he's making to play this part. So, it was fun. And a lot of the soullessness then is obviously enacted in this sort of playing out of Uncle Vanya. And, I just had to think of what's the most wrong-headed way to play Uncle Vanya, and that was to do it sort of like it's a musical or a soap opera or something. That seemed to me – but to be able to be so ridiculously fully confident about it was really fun. So she had some idea that in some way it's – it takes away – I don't know, that There's some notion that doubt and self-doubt and angst are necessary maybe to making the correct choices, to being empathetic in some way and making the right emotional choices.
Well, you know, I have to say one of the fun things about watching this and your performance is that, you know, as the movie progresses, we see different moments where you're trying to make to rehearse for this play, Uncle Vanya. Mm. And there's a part where you're just struggling with it initially, and then you have mm-hmm. no soul and you're just awful. And then mm-hmm. if you eventually, of course, get a transplanted soul of a Russian poet and are great. Yeah.
I guess great. Thanks. Thanks for saying that. I think I'm better than bad. So, but still, yes.
Well, it's you can certainly see the difference. And I was thinking about how tricky it must be. I mean, it's probably easy for an actor to play a bad actor. But the first one where you're not bad but just not quite getting it, I wonder if that took some effort.
That did take some more effort. Yeah, there's a sort of intermediary stage where he's sort of lost his balance and he doesn't quite know what. That was a little bit more tricky to figure out because then it's not the full-blown bad thing. That was a little bit trickier, the intermediary stage. But as I say, the full-blown bad thing is fun to do. And once I sort of hooked into the idea, as I say, of a sort of musical or soap opera, you could really just run with it and have a good time.
Let's listen to just a little bit of Paul Giamatti in the film, his new film, Cold Souls. Here's some of your performance after you've lost your soul and are pretty bad.
My life is gone. I have talent, intelligence, boldness. I could have been a Schopenhauer, a Dostoevsky. I'm losing it. Mother! Mother! I'm desperate. Mother! Mother!
Let's go again. Is Schopenhauer getting in your way or something?
No. Schopenhauer's fine with me. Schopenhauer.
And that's our guest Paul Giamatti in the film, his new film, Cold Souls. You know, the soul is pretty serious stuff, and yeah. And there are elements of the story here which have some tragedy and some dark and moody moments. And yet it's funny in ways. I mean, talk a little bit about finding the comedy in something like this.
Well, you know, at the risk of sounding really pretentious, it's a Chekhov play we're working on in the movie, and I think she was looking for a kind of Chekhovian tone. You know, those plays are he called them comedies, and they're funny, even though what's going on is awfully sort of tragic. And part of what's funny about them is the extremity of it. I mean, Vanya's so depressive that it's funny. It becomes absurd. And he whips out a gun and tries to shoot the guy, but he can't shoot straight. He's never held a gun in his life. He doesn't know what the hell he's doing with it. But he's reached such a ridiculously extreme emotional point that – so I think some of the tone was somewhat in there, was borrowed from that kind of thing. That, yeah, and it demands a lot of an audience. There are tonal shifts, but I think they're consistent. She did a good job, I think, of keeping it consistent.
If you're just joining us, our guest is actor Paul Giamatti. He is starring in the new film, Cold Souls. Well, last year you had this big project, the HBO 7-part series, John Adams, at which you played John Adams and got a lot of critical acclaim for this. And it was interesting. Tom Hooper was talking about casting you, and he described Adams as somebody who's irascible, somebody with anger management problems. And he says Giamatti fit in the sense that he had his idea of Adams an anti-hero to explore the flaws of the man in addition to his greatness, and that you, Paul Giamatti, were great at creating portraits of men struggling with demons. And you knew that if you cast Paul Giamatti, you'd get a fresh look at the revolution. All that makes sense to you?
Yeah, I think that was the idea. I was interested. You know, they sent me that script, and it was like a phone book. It was just this enormous thing, and I really didn't know much about Adams. And I read it, and I thought this guy seemed like a nightmare. He just seemed like a huge pain in the neck. And I said to them, I'm very interested in doing this. I think it's very interesting that you've picked a guy who's a real pain in the ass to be the central character in this. And I'd like to really preserve that. I want to be sure that I was very actively interested in making it hard for the audience to like him. And I thought, this will be interesting because our conception of these guys is so, we've made such heroes out of them and
right.
such sort of marble busts out of them. They're on the money, you know. And I thought, we all love what these guys did. And I'd like to make it tricky for people. I'd like to have a little tension and anxiety induced in people by saying, but he's a nightmare. He's a pain in the ass. But he did these great things. And so I was definitely interested in that. And hopefully that comes across.
All right. Let's get a little taste of this character. This is a moment where you as John Adams, the struggle between England and the colonies has come to the point where it's time to consider declaring independence, and you are explaining to Thomas Jefferson, played here by Stephen Delane, why you want him to write the Declaration of Independence.
But we must first achieve this long-hoped-for separation, and to that end we must have a declaration of principles.
Should you not write this thing yourself?
No. I do not have time. No, I head the Board of War and Ordnance as well as serving on 22 other committees. And the outcome of this great question is far from certain, so my energies must be spent leading the debate on the floor.
And why me?
Reasons enough, sir.
What can possibly be your reasons?
First, you are a Virginian. And a Virginian should be at the head of this business, as it's the most powerful state. Second, I am obnoxious, suspected, and unpopular. And you are very much otherwise. Third, and perhaps most important, I have read your summary view of the rights of British America. And I have a great opinion of the elegance of your pen. And none at all of my own.
You're too modest, sir.
Well, you were the first to find me so, sir. Now, I am not by nature a humble man, but circumstances sometimes require a change of habits.
And that's our guest, Paul Giamatti, with Stephen Delane in the series John Adams. You know, you were quoted in a recent piece in The New Yorker as saying that you seem to get roles of playing characters who are in a constant state of agitation. But you also play a lot of guys who have issues of, you know, self-confidence and self-doubt. And Adams, although he may have his neuroses, is not like this. This is a guy who desires and understands how to wield power. Was that kind of a different turn for you?
Yeah, that was interesting. And I think he broke through a lot of neuroses to get to that place. But certainly, in terms of kind of conducting the revolution and doing all of that stuff, yeah, he was a pit bull, and he was deeply self-confident. And yeah, that was fun to do. And again, there's something contradictory in that because he was neurotic as well. And so that was a nice sort of contradictory thing to do and to also be able to play that self-confidence. So lots of facets to the guy, you know.
This was, I understand, a pretty grueling effort. I mean, you were in every scene of this, and it was a 7-part series. And you underwent this physical transformation of, you know, all the costume and the wigs. And I don't know, was there some denture thing that you had to wear?
they painted my teeth brown. Yeah,
because
everybody
–
he had no teeth basically by the time he was, I think, 35. Nobody had teeth. Very few people had teeth. So – and I thought, I can't go with the whole crazy denture thing with like two jagged, snarly teeth. I thought, you know, painting them will be enough. So we painted my teeth.
Well, talk just a little bit about kind of the physical trappings and does it make it harder or easier to find and hold the character when you're wearing all that stuff?
Oh, well, it's – yeah. It was tricky. It would have been nice to have had some time to kind of have gradual stages of, you know, when I first got there, I had worn some of this stuff, but I'd sort of worn the makeup at one time, and then I'd been fitted for the costume at a different time, and then I'd seen all the props I was going to have. And when I first got there, they loaded it all on me, and it did. It was a funny balancing act. It felt like a kind of, you know, rubbing your stomach and tapping your head and whistling Dixie kind of thing all at the same time. But I eventually got it. I like things like that. I like period things. The costumes give you a huge amount, and I like having an accent to work on and things like that. Those things make me feel comfortable. Yeah, coordinating all of them can be tricky, especially if you're, you know, if you have limited time. It can be tricky.
We're speaking with Paul Giamatti. His new film is Cold Souls. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, our guest is actor Paul Giamatti. He starred in Sideways and the HBO series John Adams. His new film is Cold Souls. When you're shooting, do you watch TV and movies and other stuff, or are you one of those who likes to kind of wall yourself off and stay unfocused?
I tend to want to wall myself off. If I'm going to watch something, I'd like it to be something that feels like it's the right mood, you know, and not necessarily, you know, on the nose, but I'll read and watch things that'll keep me sort of in the right area. You know, I did this movie, Cinderella Man, which
sure.
is a boxing movie set in the 30s, and I did some boxing research, and I hung around with boxers, and that was good. But I did a lot of kind of, you know, I was reading stuff from the period, and I was watching all different kinds of movies from the period. And that sometimes just to help me keep me in the mood, because I like to watch movies. I don't think I could wall myself off entirely. But if I can find something that's in the right mood, I'll try to stay there.
When you were shooting John Adams, were you in a Revolutionary War character's mentality for what was it, 8 months?
Yeah. Well, that was – I mean, I did do a lot of reading about that, and there was lots to read. At a certain point, I had to stop because it was information overload, and I had to just be able to get on with the part. And I kept reading the letters throughout it just to kind of keep me in the right mood. But – my presence was so constant in that thing that I was just locked into Revolutionary thing all the time because I was always in that damn costume and always on the set and always – I never shut up. And so it was full immersion whether I wanted it or not, you know.
You know, what makes the series interesting, of course, is – I mean, I think the stuff about the revolution and the battle with the British is, of course, fascinating. But there's also this, you know, deep and complex relationship, you know, with your wife who's so ably played by Laura Linney. And there was a moment in the film where you, as John Adams, you've been in Paris for a long time, for many, many months. And she comes over and – and there's the relationship has been strained by Adams' long absence and his little correspondence with his wife. But they get together and find themselves in a moment of passion. This was sort of this interesting portrayal of an 18th century relationship and 18th century sex. I wonder if you could say a little bit about that scene.
It was really nice. It's also kind of middle-aged 18th century sex. You know, I mean, it's kind of older people and they've been separated. Yeah, you know. Originally, that scene, we were supposed to walk in, and it didn't go really beyond us just kind of kissing. And Laura and I talked beforehand about it and said, why don't we just kind of keep going, and hopefully they'll keep going. And so we did, and we didn't know what we were going to do, really. I had sort of talked to one of the – they had sort of historical consultants around, and a lot of those people did have sex with all their clothes on. They didn't remove that. I think the French were the people who took all their clothes off for the most part. But I don't know that Americans did at the time. At least this one person said to me. So I had that in my back pocket knowing, yeah, we can – we'll keep our clothes on. The toughest thing was what do you do with the wig? What's the deal with the wig? And we thought, well, maybe that's a kind of – Laura said maybe, you know – the bald head is a sort of erotic thing for the woman. So she does this kind of wonderful slipping of the wig off and rubbing my bald head. And, you know, I don't know. We imagined a lot of it. We kind of made it up. But we really kind of just went for it without telling we were going to do it in the first take of it. And we just kept going. And the scene went on a lot longer. Thankfully, they cut it way down, although it makes me look like I don't have staying power, which bothered me. But it was a much longer scene, and we just kind of went for it. And I don't know what audiences made of it. I think some people were a little taken aback at seeing these great Americans having sex as if they never did. And these people really did. I mean, They wrote in their letters, they talked about their sex life, and she – they were very sexual people with each other, I think. It certainly seems like it in their letters. So we just thought we would go for it. I figured, you know, why not?
Well, it's a scene that stuck with me.
Did it give you nightmares or was it it a good thing?
It just made me wonder, is that what it was like back then?
I wonder. I don't know, you know. I mean, the women didn't wear underwear, which was interesting. But they didn't take much of their other clothing off, and so it has some fascinating things to it.
And not to belabor this, but the director and the crew did not know that you and Laura were going to go beyond the kiss?
No, but they just kept filming, which was what was great about them. They were a crack crew, and I knew that the director would probably enjoy this, watching us go at it, just because he had an eye towards taking things in a different direction and not being so reverent. And so we had a feeling he would probably be all for it if we kept going. And so we did. And then eventually, you know, they decided to then actually work it into the scene, and then it became the scene, and then they shot it appropriately.
Paul Giamatti's new film is Cold Souls. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. Back with actor Paul Giamatti, who's starring in the new film Cold Souls. He's also appeared in Private Parts, American Splendor, and Sideways, and he starred in the HBO series John Adams. We can't talk about your career without talking about Sideways, directed by Alexander Payne. And let's hear a little bit of your clip here. This your character Miles, who is a struggling writer and school teacher and depressed wine buff. Here he is in a conversation with a romantic interest who's played by Virginia Madsen. She begins by asking him a question.
Can I ask you a personal question, Miles?
Sure.
Why are you so into Pinot? I mean, it's like a thing with you.
I don't know. It's a hard grape to grow, as you know, right? It's thin-skinned, temperamental, ripens early. It's not a survivor like Cabernet, which can just grow anywhere and thrive even when it's neglected. Nah, Pinot needs constant care and attention. You know, and in fact, it can only grow in these really specific little tucked away corners of the world. And only the most patient and nurturing of growers can do it, really. Only somebody who really takes the time to understand Pinot's potential can then coax it into its fullest expression.
Tell us about this character, Miles, that you play.
Oh, it was a hard part. I found that one of the more difficult parts I've ever played, and maybe to some extent because I hadn't really had such a sort of full-blown central character to play in something. I mean, I'd done some other large parts, but this was really, you know, I'm in every scene of that movie, and it was a lot to take on. And yeah, he's an interesting guy. Again, you know, here's a guy that's hard for the audience to swallow. You know, he's a very prickly, difficult guy. He's a bit of a loser, you know. I mean, I he's the only character I've played that I think of as a bit of actually a loser. I mean, he's so self-sabotaging and so unable to connect in any sensible way with people. He does with Virginia's character eventually, which is she gives him and the audience some hope for him. But you know, the in for this character was the wine stuff, was his interest in the wine. That was the key to the guy. And as much as it's a kind of pompous thing, and it's played as a bit of a sort of pompous thing, there's a genuine, refined sensibility in the guy behind it all, which is what I think attracts her to him. So underneath it, there's something very, very refined about the guy. And you kind of hope he's going to go the right way and follow that part of his character and not the awful parts.
Did you hang out with wine buffs to get that feel?
I did a bit, yeah. No, I did. And not really to I mean, all the wine stuff I had to say in the movie was in the script. I was more interested in the sort of behavioral stuff, you know, the way you rotate the glass and tilt it and look at things. And it's all this highly codified. It's like, you know, Japanese tea ceremony kind of thing. You know, it's wonderful. And the personality that loves it is a personality that loves all that kind of minutiae and detail and paraphernalia and all that kind of stuff. So there's a lot of wonderful stuff in there.
Well, you had played a lead before, but this was a romantic lead. Was that a difference that mattered?
Oh, sure, yeah. And I liked the fact that it was very adult. You know, it wasn't – you know, I'm not the typical leading man guy. But that was never used as a gag in the movie. It was never used as, you know, it was just presented as this happens to be this guy and this woman just finds him attractive for whatever reason. There wasn't any sort of thing about it. It was very, it was adult, and I liked that about it.
Well, I want to play another clip from a film of yours that I really liked, one that's not so well known. And rather than set it up, I want to just play it and then we can talk about it. This is one of my favorite Paul Giamatti film moments.
Oh, she may be weary, and young girls, they do get wearied wearing that same old shaggy dress.
Yeah.
But when she gets weary,
she gets weary.
Try a little tenderness.
And that is Paul Giamatti with another actor, Andre Brouwer, in the film Duets. Tell the audience about this film.
This is a movie. I have a lot of affection for this movie, too. It was directed by Bruce Paltrow, who's Gwyneth Paltrow's father. And it was a very funny kind of, you know, there's a very kind of 70s feel to this movie, and I got it, and it's dark and odd and strange, and I don't know if it's a great movie, but I really like it. And in it I play a kind of mid-level salesman type who's burnt out from traveling, and he becomes obsessed with karaoke while he's on the road, and he leaves his family to kind of pursue karaoke. And it's a culty movie. There's people who really love this movie, which is nice.
Yeah, I thought it really worked, and it's got this great cast with Gwyneth Paltrow and Maria Bello and Huey Lewis of Huey Lewis in the News, who plays a karaoke hustler who goes into bars and pretends not to know anything, and then gets the prize money.
Yeah.
And, you know, that song that you sing with Andre Brouwer, I Try a Little Tenderness, I mean, it really gets good. It sounds like you know what you're doing. Have you sung? Have you done some singing in your life?
No, I really hadn't. I mean, I remember when I went in to audition for that movie and they said, that's great, and the part is yours, and that's wonderful. And then a little while later, they came to me and said, by the way, do you sing? And I said, no. And I was assuming they would have somebody else sing the part. And because I hadn't ever really sung, and I still don't consider myself a singer, but I'd never done musical theater or anything like that. And I went to sort of hang out with Andre while he practiced the song, and they had the guy there who was going to sing my part. And he said, you know, it would be so much better if you don't lip sync this. Why don't you just try it? So I sang it, and they were all like, hey, that's not bad. And so I ended up singing it, and I loved doing it. I absolutely loved doing it, which was great because that's what happens to the character in the movie. He doesn't know he can sing, and he starts to sing, and he loves it. And so it really all kind of fit together nicely for the character.
All right. Well, if the audience wants a Paul Giamatti weekend, this is a must-see.
Oh, Jesus. Wow, that's a dark weekend. I don't know about that.
I read in an interview that you described yourself as a messy actor. Do you recall that? Do you know what you meant?
I don't recall when I said it, but I can imagine I did say it. Yeah, I suppose, you know, discipline. I'm not the most disciplined person in my life in general, and probably one of the places where I am the most disciplined was in acting, and it may be one of the things I liked about it. It's sort of I could focus and found things to focus on. But yeah, I'm all for messiness in things. I mean, it's not the greatest virtue, but I like things being a little ragged at the edges sometimes. Maybe it's just an excuse for crappy acting. I don't know, but I like it in other sort of works of art too. You know, it's funny how literature is all about kind of clean lines now, and so few people write big, baggy, loose, crazy books anymore. And Thomas Pynchon's got a book coming out, and I always look forward to his because they're kind of a mess, you know. And there's something I really like about that, and it's I think that for a long time, cleanliness of line wasn't necessarily the object in art. Not always, not all forms of art. And I don't know. I like things being a little loose and baggy sometimes and not so on the nose all the time.
You know, you've had a lot of great supporting roles. And I read in 2004 that you said, "I think I have the mentality of a supporting actor. I don't have the chemistry of a leading actor. In some ways, I find the supporting thing harder, actually." Is that still true?
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, you know, it's a bit of an adjustment to have to play. I mean, there are things that come with playing the lead that don't have anything to do with acting. You know, you're required to be a bit more of the cheerleader, the team leader guy, and that took a bit of an adjustment for me. But I also think maybe part of what I meant by that, and still feels true, is I think, you know, it's like being a sprinter or a distance runner or something. You know, there's a kind of chemistry that I think you have, and I think I maybe work better sometimes or felt more comfortable working in a smaller space and having to kind of paint in more vivid colors in a smaller space suited me, my brain chemistry more. It's, you know, the larger canvas is its own tricky thing to try to master. So I think maybe I was just disposed to being more confined in a funny way. It is harder because you're given a lot less opportunity. You know, you got to get in and get out, and you know, you don't get as many takes and things like that. But again, I think something about that suited me more to kind of this kind of burst of energy and that laying back. You got to be ready for the long haul in the lead, and that's its own tough thing.
Well, Paul Giamatti, it's been fun. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Paul Giamatti stars in the new film Cold Souls. Let's bring him back singing with Andre Brower to finish off that performance in the film Duets.
But it's all so easy, all so easy. All you got to do is try a little tenderness.
Try a little tenderness.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. You got to squeeze her. Don't tease her. Never leave her. Squeeze her, don't tease her, never leave
her. Never leave her.
Country singer George Strait has a new album called Twang. His previous collection, Troubadour, won the 2009 Grammy Award for Best Country Album, adding to Strait's impressive industry statistics. He surpassed only by Elvis Presley and the Beatles in the number of platinum-selling albums. But rock critic Ken Tucker says Strait's achievement goes well beyond commercial success.
Working like a dog all week, I go to meet the boys for a cold one at a little joint up the street. They got a jukebox first thing I always do, 'cause I need a little twang, a little hillbilly bending on some guitar strings.
With his starched white shirts, 10-gallon hats, and chiseled handsomeness, George Strait is a throwback to a bygone era of heroic cowboy singers and actors, a twangy descendant of Roy Rogers and Gene Autry. What makes him unusual is his consistency and enduring popularity.
I used to be the one who she was always holding on to. Like a fool, I told her way too tight. He was glad to see me let go. He's all I see now in her eyes. He's got that something special, but that something special used to be mine. She sees more in him than she ever saw in me. She thinks he's got everything she'll ever need. He's got that something special, something special used to be mine.
Of course, consistency isn't the stuff of legends. Strait has never hit the newspapers with tales of wild living in a country tradition of everyone from Hank Williams to Johnny Cash to George Jones. Strait is not an outsized brash showman like Garth Brooks. Strait's true precursors are Jim Reeves and Eddie Arnold, gentlemen crooners who peaked in the 1960s as mannerly alternatives to Beatlemania. But those comparisons don't quite fit. Strait is his own man, ornery and independent in a quiet but firm way. Neither Reeves nor Arnold, for example, ever recorded a song about killing a killer as genial as this new one called Arkansas Dave.
He rode up on a winter day, steam rising off a streak-faced bay. Said, you probably know my name. If you don't, it's Arkansas Dave. He talked to 15 years ago and how he got the bay he rode. Said he killed a man in Ohio. First man he killed, first horse he stole. It was a long...
Strait and Tony Brown, his producer since his 1981 debut disc, Strait Country, have perfected a clean, crisp sound that bypasses decades of trends. That's one reason he could score hits during the heyday of outlaw country music in the 70s, and currently amidst the bloated melodrama of acts such as Rascal Flatts and Montgomery Gentry. Strait's latest hit single, Living for the Night, is a crooning ballad co-written by Strait, his son Bubba Strait, and veteran Nashville songwriter Dean Dillon.
Every day is a lifetime without you. Hard to get through since you've gone. So I do the only thing I know how to get by. I'm living for the night.
That song is no masterpiece, but it's a pretty piece of work and unusual in this respect. It's the first song Strait has written since his 1981 debut. And this new collaborating method with his son Bubba has resulted in the best song on Twang, the honky-tonk waltz called Out of Sight, Out of Mind.
I always heard people say, but I guess I never fully understood it. I thought that they meant you'd be easy to forget, but it's driving me crazy. Out of sight, out of mind.
The twang in Strait's Texas-born voice and his prominent pedal steel and fiddle backup have kept Strait from crossing over to pop stardom, which is just the way this courtly, modest performer likes it. Having sold 67 million albums and counting, he has nothing to prove. But that doesn't mean he doesn't prove consistency can be a viable, vital artistic reward.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large at Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Twang by George Strait. Although it's easy to categorize Jennifer Weiner's new novel, called Best Friends Forever, as a beach book, book critic Maureen Corrigan says you'll never make it out to the beach once you start reading it.
If you think Chick Lit is unworthy of critical attention, go away. If, however, you believe, as I do, that there are only two categories of books in the world, good books and the other kind, thank you, Duke Ellington, then I've got a terrific summer read to celebrate. It's the new novel by Chick Lit writer Jennifer Weiner, and the only thing lame about it is its title, Best Friends Forever. Weiner's latest novel is already wedged into a special bookcase with the other books I reread every so often just because they make me happy. Novels like Jeanette Haynes' Matters of Chance, Susan Isaacs' Shining Through, Kingsley Amis's Lucky Jim, and of course, Pride and Prejudice, the mother of all chick lit. What most of these and the other novels on that shelf have in common is that they're smart, witty fairy tales for grown-ups. Bad things may happen to the flawed heroine or hero of these stories, but in the end, the deserving dark horse triumphs. Most of Weiner's previous novels and short stories fit this plot profile, but what sets Best Friends Forever apart is its tough emotional wisdom. If there are any doubts that a work of mere chick lit can be deeply revelatory, Best Friends Forever should banish them. It goes without saying that this novel is also very funny. Weiner has made her literary mark by generating a roll of the eyeballs attitude toward elusive boyfriends, haughty health club staff, and the countless other walking torments that populate her heroine's suburban landscapes. When this novel opens, 32-year-old Addie Downs has just returned from yet another blind date, courtesy of the internet. The loser du jour confessed over dinner that he'd been violated by space aliens. Because Addie lives such a solitary life, her parents are dead, she works at home making paintings to be turned into greeting cards, and she's currently, as she says, friend-free. She printed out a note and taped it to her fridge before she left for the aforesaid doomed date. The text, in full, conveys Addie's bruised but droll worldview. It reads, "I went to meet Matthew Sharp on Friday, November 23rd. If anything happened to me, it's probably his fault. P.S. I would like a military funeral." Happily, Addie is not destined to remain alone that evening. Even as she's snuggling into post-date PJs, a knock comes at her door. It's her old best friend, Valerie Adler, whom Addie hasn't seen since they were both seniors in high school, and Valerie dumped her for the cool kids. Blonde, thin, gorgeous Valerie, who's now a TV weather girl, has just come from their local high school reunion, the reunion Addie resolutely avoided. Valerie is wearing a blood-stained coat, and she thinks she may have, accidentally on purpose, run over the loutish former class football hunk after enticing him to take off his pants in the reunion hotel parking lot. "Please help me," the long-lost Valerie pleads. "You broke my heart," is the bitter accusation that rises to Addie's lips. But in a gesture that affirms female solidarity over historical memory, Addie gets into Valerie's waiting Jag, and the two ride off into an excursion back into their shared past, as well as into a present-time comical riff on Thelma and Louise. Since Weiner's narrative jumps around in terms of chronology and point of view, the story, as it evolves, complicates a reader's first impressions, particularly of Addie. Sure, she's doing okay now, but how would she have struck even the most sympathetic of onlookers on that day a few years ago when she weighed in at around 350 pounds and found herself helplessly stuck inside a booth in the town diner? Slowly, within the main light crime story, Weiner intersperses flashbacks to Addie's shy childhood, to the daily ebbs and flows of intense adolescent girl friendship, and to the personal tragedies that, until a couple of years ago, had turned Addie into a morbidly obese recluse. All belief in life's possibilities vanished. Addie is one of the most compelling nice girls popular literature has ever produced. And because Weiner understandably loves her own creation, she grants her the gift of a redeeming second act in life. Addie's story rates a second, and perhaps even a third, read too, because its unrelenting depiction of loneliness, as well as the myriad ways people can surprise themselves and each other, deserve to be savored again and again.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Best Friends Forever by Jennifer Weiner.